Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 291. Well, welcome back to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. My name is Bob Tarullo. I serve as pastor of Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Countryside, Illinois. And with me, via Zoom, I have Rob McKenzie here. Hey, Rob, how's it going? Elder at Westminster as well. I forgot to announce you in the proper way.
It's fine. This is going to be an interesting show. Apparently, everything is funny to you right
well,
now.
Again, I am sleepy. As
you
as
are sleepy.
Yes, you kind of brought that. No, I was trying to do the announcing thing of doing a variation every time to give your wife a little chuckle, you know, as she
listens at some point. Yes, and yeah, but apparently numbers 291 were funny to you. You said 291 and you started laughing.
Yeah. I don't know why. One
of those funny numbers?
I think it was the way I said it made me laugh.
Okay. We've done episodes before where we're both tired.
Yes,
we're both really tired.
Yes, but
I'm not actually right now, but you are.
My apologies, everybody. My apologies.
This is good. I might be able to throw some stuff out there to really get you laughing. Or you'll fall asleep in the middle of the episode, and I'll just carry on.
I don't think I'll fall asleep. Sorry.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
Here we go. Okay. So anyway, let's move up to a little seriousness here.
Okay. We can do that.
Last couple weeks have been really busy. You were doing the arrangements for our General Assembly,
yes,
where representatives from the OPC come and just have knockdown, drag out fights.
I wouldn't describe it exactly like that, Rob, but I was working for the OPC. On the Committee for Arrangements of the General Assembly. It's a General Assembly committee. Been on it, I think, about 10 years now, maybe 11. I don't know, however many years I've been here. It was about the same time that I got on it that I took the call here. But I'm thankful. Pretty much ever since I got in the OPC, I've been able to participate at the General Assembly by, like, helping. I started off helping as a page when I was, a college student when I first became a member at Geneva College, when we would have General Assemblies were there at Geneva College.
Page?
I was a page, yeah. Like those, yeah.
Wait, they've got kids as pages.
Yeah, they didn't do that then.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I remember it was myself, because they also needed tellers, because you had to count votes. No, you had to count votes. Like we didn't have digital voting then. And so you'd hand out sheets for voting and for electing mostly. It was mostly for elections, but that took up a big part of the time. And then we had, we came into the 21st century and got electronic voting devices. And that changed our elections quite a lot. And now I can control everything. No, that was a joke. Everyone makes a joke because I live in Chicago and I do the voting devices that, I can manipulate the outcome. Right. And that's just not the case.
Well, for everybody, all the commissioners that are from Chicago get two or three voting devices.
No. Okay. I'm just going to nip that right there. Well, we do everything above board when we are doing elections and voting, all that kind of stuff. Anyhow. So yeah, we had General Assembly nearby in the Chicagoland area at Trinity Christian College, which is a great venue for General Assemblies of our size. Great people to work with, and so we're very thankful for that. And a part of the work that I do there is just making sure the arrangements go smoothly. And so sometimes they go really, really well. Sometimes they go less well, but almost always they work. And we're thankful they go really well at Trinity, and they seem to have done that this year. We had a wonderful opening worship service. We had great worship on the Lord's Day. So that's one thing that might be a little different from our assemblies for some others, is that we go over a Lord's Day, not not all the time, but 95, 99% of the time we do. That just seems to be the preferred way for most of the commissioners. And that gives the commissioners opportunity to go to local churches if we're in an area where there are local churches. And that's what we, you know, we had about close to 20 extra people. Or no, we had more than 20 extra people as a result of General Assembly. Some fraternal delegates from different parts of the world and commissioners from all over the country at our church service. But also, you know, all over, all the different OPC churches in Chicagoland had people from all over the world and different parts of the country. So I think that's a wonderful way of doing our General Assembly. And the guys seem to enjoy it as well. And we have good fellowship in the evenings. The president of the college opened up his house, his lawn, I should say, his fire pit, so that guys could hang out after that, have a fire, and enjoy some good fellowship. And so, yeah, it was good. And there was really good debate during General Assembly on some key issues. You know, I think people can go to opc.org and look at the feature to get a sense of what a General Assembly is like through the update that is there. There's a daily update that gets posted, and that should still be there. But, yeah, you were there. Melody, your wife, helped greatly. And she's helped in the past, but she really had to step in. One of our key figures, our registrar, came down ill and wasn't able to make it at all. And so we were thankful that Melody, well, for all the prep that key person did, but then that Melody could step in and just sort of be there, along with some other wonderful, well, I don't want to call them, well, they're not paid, but staff, people that came and volunteered to help, right? So it was good, real good. I love I love the OPC. I'm so thankful for her.
Yes, yeah, so am I. And yeah, it was.
And all of our foibles and failures. Right. We're absolutely. We're not the perfect, Lord's provision.
But yeah. And it's a great thing that, you know, we can see, you know, people that we only see once a year.
Yeah.
You know, if that.
Right.
And so that was nice to be able to just sit down and have lunch with, you know, several people that, you know, I hadn't seen in a few years, actually.
Yeah. And that we had a joint Chicagoland evening worship service. So where all the Chicagoland worship services or churches, as many people from them as that wanted to come, came together, and one of the pages did count. And so he counted 430 of us gathering together. Now, I know for some churches, you know, denominations, that's, you know, that's normal Sunday.
That's an evening service for them.
But that's a good group of Orthodox Presbyterians gathering together to lift our voices in praise to the Lord. Listening to our General Secretary for Foreign Missions preach God's Word, Douglas Clausen, and so yeah, it was a great blessing. I thought tiring in many ways,
yeah,
but a delight to the soul.
It's good.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Well, you mentioned 291, so let's see what can make you laugh in the actual episode.
Well, our topic, right? So, it's been a few weeks because of General Assembly. So, last time we started the chapter by Burkhoff on the states of Christ. In our catechisms, it's called the estate of Christ. There's two estates: is a state of humiliation and a state of exaltation. We started and we did the estate of humiliation last time, and so we're kind of pick up toward the end of that, and now we're going to deal with the estate of crisis state of exaltation. So take it away, Robbie.
Oh dear. You need a nap. Burkhoff, you know, where we kind of broke off, you know, Christ has come to the cross, and I mean, what is more depictive of the humiliation of Christ than him being counted as a criminal, not only by the Jewish nation, who then, because they want him executed, but they don't have the authority to do that exactly, even though there are other times where they are given the authority. That's another episode. We can talk about what they were trying to do. But they hand him over to Rome, and Rome, so officially Christ is labeled as a criminal worthy of crucifixion, the worst form of the death penalty that Rome had. And you know, it's telling when Christ says, "Well, if you wanted to, he could ask the Father, and what is it? You know, 12 legions of angels would come. Is that like 10? It was in legion 10,000, so 120,000 angels can come and basically deliver him from what was about to happen. But Christ goes willingly to the cross, and then of course on the cross, the actual enduring of crucifixion that he goes through is, again, humiliating. Mm-hmm. And we know that, we talked about that the humiliation is much more than the physical, but still physical aspects are part of it. And him being on the cross, having the Roman soldiers mock him and spit on him, and they cast lots for his clothes, and you know, when he was being brought to the cross, you know, just the bearing of the cross that he did, where he actually physically couldn't do it because he had gone through so much already that night with the crown of thorns on his head, and he was beaten, and he stumbles, he can't carry the cross, and that's where the man I'm blanking on his name of Cyrene,
Cyrene, yeah.
Simon, sorry, yeah. And he has to help Jesus mm-hmm. carry the cross up. I mean, all that is an act of humiliation. And as we got to last week, or last time we were here, we get to the place of Christ on the cross saying, "It is finished." Mm-hmm. And Burkhoff talks about that he actually, we can't say that when Jesus says "it is finished," this is talking about his humiliation, because there's still part of that. He hasn't ascended yet. His exaltation comes when he ascends. And so Burkhoff makes a point that just the fact that Christ is placed in a tomb is still part of his humiliation. But then when he's resurrected, you know, he's resurrected still in glorification, in a glorified body. He's the first fruits. But his exaltation will begin when he ascends, and it's something that when we've had movies, right? Mm-hmm. The Passion of the Christ, and there's currently this.
Never seen it.
Neither have I actually. But
The Chosen.
Chosen that's on right now. I've never seen that as well. But they're never going to be able to depict the reality of Christ. It's impossible for us to do, because, well, first of all, he was both divine and human, and they can never, in a movie or in TV, they can never depict the divinity within Christ that would have been apparent when you were talking to him.
And nor should they attempt to do it, the divinity.
No, right? They should. Yeah, right. I mean, you know, that's where all of a sudden, yeah, you know, you see the halo following him around or whatever. Well, that wasn't happening when Christ was here. But that, again, was part of his humiliation, that he, to see him was to see him human, but to actually converse with him, you should have been able to see the divine, because that's what he chides the disciples for. When they say, "Well, show us the Father," and he says, "How long have I been with you? Mm-hmm. How do you not recognize the Father? Do you recognize me? Then you should recognize the Father." And that wasn't talking about a physical thing. It was talking about his spirit, who Christ is. He is God. And so they should have been able to understand that. And yet, on the cross, it's always interesting that, you know, here's crucifixion, which is a horrific way to die, and it's a long. Usually, people would be crucified, and it would take hours and hours and hours before they would die. And the Romans had devised it like that because they wanted the victim to suffer, and that's why they're going to go break the legs, because if you haven't died yet, then they break your legs and you die. And they wanted to make sure that everybody was dead for the Sabbath, but Christ gives up his spirit. He dies. He willingly dies. Again, part of why he came. When he says, "It is finished," the mission that he had that began with his birth he accomplished it at the cross, and that's the it is finished that we see.
Yeah, I mean, not to belabor the point, it's a good point to belabor, but we're going to move on. The end is finished is the sacrifice, the substitution, mm-hmm. the atonement. That part of the work on the cross is complete. It's done. Now, as you said, more suffering to come, and that being brought into the grave, being dead for a time, mm-hmm. That is still all a part of his humiliation. But that humiliation is described in what's called the ecumenical creeds, the Apostles' Creed, as his descent into Hades or his descent mm-hmm. into hell, depending on which translation or use of the Apostles' Creed you are making. And that's been variously interpreted, and Burkhoff gets into that just a bit. To talk about a Roman Catholic view, a Lutheran view, and then he provides what he thinks is the best view for sort of Reform folk, which he calls understanding it figuratively. And he says, and actually he says, in all probability, it is figurative for two points, that he suffered the pangs, that is, that Jesus suffered the pangs of hell in the garden and on the cross, and that he entered the deepest humiliation of the state of death. And it's good to know that our catechism also speaks of it in terms of being descending into hell in question number 50 of the larger catechism. There, the larger catechism says, wherein consists Christ's humiliation after his death? And our larger catechism says, Christ's humiliation after his death consisted in his being buried, and continuing in the state of the dead, and under the power of death till the third day, which hath been otherwise expressed in these words, he descended into hell. Now, the Heidelberg Catechism also answers this question because it goes through the Apostles' Creed. Our catechisms mm-hmm. don't do that. The Heidelberg Catechism does. And it says, why does the Creed add, he descended into hell? The answer it provided there is, to assure me during attacks of deepest dread and temptation that Christ my Lord, by suffering unspeakable anguish, pain, and terror of the soul, or terror of soul, on the cross, but also earlier, has delivered me from hellish anguish and torment. And so there, I think, from those two answers, at least confessionally, catechetically, it goes to support, in part, Burkhoff's language of figuratively, you know, because they, mm-hmm. especially the Heidelberg referring to it, it speaks to me of my freedom from the anguish and pains of hell, because Christ took that anguish and the pains of hell upon himself. And so I think that's probably, in my mind, the best way to understand the descent into hell, or the descent into Hades, or the death, into mm-hmm. the place of the dead. Because we certainly don't believe as Catholics or Lutherans, at least according to the way in which it's described here in Burkhoff's book. He says that Catholics believe that Christ went down into the limbus patrum, where Old Testament saints were confined to release them, and that Lutherans believe that he went between his death and resurrection. He went down to hell to preach and to celebrate his victory over the powers of darkness, pulling on language from 2 Peter, if I remember correctly. So, but I don't think that's not how we've taken it historically, nor is it something that I want to say Christ went into hell in any particular way, nor do I think he went into the limbus patrum.
Right. Because you were in a very liberal church growing up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember them, what they were teaching on this?
Oh, no.
If they were
not at all.
No.
Now, I remember saying it during a worship service.
Sure.
But I don't remember. I mean, there might be. I don't remember any teaching. If there was any teaching on it, it would have been during confirmation, which is when the catechism was pulled out. The only time I remember the catechism being pulled out. And it wasn't the 39 articles that was pulled out. So it was Episcopalian. But there was a catechism in the Book of Church. No, Book of Common Prayer. I was thinking Book of Church Order. No, in the Book of Common Prayer, there was a newer catechism. I honestly, I just don't remember. I'm sure it taught on it, but I don't remember what it said. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. When in my circles, independent Bible churches, dispensational. I mean, we never, the Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed. So we didn't use those.
Yeah, Bible only, right? No creed but Christ.
No, that's right. Yeah. And your doctrinal statement, yeah. But that's not.
Oh, and your doctrinal statement. Sorry about that.
But they don't talk about that. It's. I didn't even know what the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed was until I was in college. But what we always talked about is that Christ dies and goes, is buried, and he went into Abraham's bosom, and all the people who had died before the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. So the Old Testament saints were in Abraham's bosom, and that Christ went and brought them to heaven.
That sounds because a lot like the Roman Catholic position.
It does.
Yeah.
It does actually. Yeah. I never realized actually until studying Burkhoff this time. I never made that connection before with the Roman Catholic view and the view that I actually had been growing up. Now, even in my circles, even in dispensational circles, there are, some competing opinions, and everybody says this is not the most concrete of, they're still guessing. They understand that this is kind of like, this is really hard. We don't know exactly what happens. This is what we think happened. So they aren't going to, slam their fist down and say, this is 100% true. They're just going to say, we think to the best of what we can understand, this is what's true. And then there is the idea that Christ also, because with Abraham's bosom, remember, it's divided into two.
Two bosoms?
It's on one side you have paradise, and the other side you have hell or Hades, because when the rich man and Lazarus, so Lazarus goes to Abraham's bosom, but you can still talk to somebody that's in torment. And so because of that, obviously they're together. So Christ goes to Abraham's bosom where he can now preach to all those who are in now, this is preaching to those who died during the days of Noah is where they're going with this. Now, this isn't a second chance theory or anything like that. Nobody gets a second chance. This is just Christ is proclaiming who he is, that he is the way of salvation. But of course, it's they've rejected him. They rejected him, and so. Then he leads, he cleans out, you hear this language, he clears out Abraham's bosom and takes them to heaven. So, yeah, it is interesting how it's a lot like the Catholic view.
Interesting. The things you learn on theology, simply profound. <'Cause> or just read that. Summary of Christian doctrine.
That's true. But he doesn't bring up the Abraham's
dispensational
bosom
connection,
thing,
yeah. Interesting.
But and this is something that, while it is interesting, I have known some people that have really worried about what this means. Mm-hmm. Spent more time on it than they really should have. Than was profitable for them. Mm-hmm. So we have to remember that this is very mysterious. This is very allegorical might be the best way to put it. It's a hard saying. And so it's fine to try to figure out what it means, but we can't let it take us away from the clear truths of the gospel.
And speaking of that, what comes after this?
This, that he is brought up to heaven in the ascension.
Well, he gets resurrected first.
And that is his exaltation. Well, yeah, I thought we already talked about that.
Yeah, well, the estate of exaltation, right? So yeah. From here, he... you know, is in the grave and then he's not, right? What was it in Mark's, was it Mark's gospel or Matthew's gospel? I can't remember off the top of my head now. They come and roll the stone away in order to find out that he's not there. I think it's Mark's gospel.
Yes. Yeah.
No.
Matthew's gospel. To roll it away.
Yeah. So he's out of it before it's being rolled away. It's not like he's on the other side and he's got a button, pushes it and it rolls away. Right. Or he uses his divine strength and power to break it apart with, you know, like some dynamite, but he's gone. I mean, he supernaturally is raised from the dead and his physical body, his new raised up body is outside of the tomb without having moved the rock that was covering it. Because the women come and they say, you know, roll away the stone. And then they had to roll it away. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me, the stone being rolled away, because it's not like Jesus needed the stone to be rolled away to get out. He goes through a door when the disciples are up in a room and the door's locked. He just enters. He travels very quickly from the road to Emmaus. He's vanishes out of their sight. He doesn't need that stone rolled away, but it becomes a very significant image to us when we see that stone rolled away. So, you know, because the angel could have just met the women when they came. They could have met Peter and John when they come, and the angel could have said, he's not here. He's risen. But they actually get to enter the tomb, which is better for them. I mean, they can actually see his body is not there. I guess that would have also led to more rumors. Well, you know, the tomb is still sealed. But for us, I think it becomes very comforting in its symbolism that we can talk about the empty tomb, that we can talk about the stone was rolled away. The tomb is empty. Christ is not there. He is risen. For us to have that image in our heads, I think is very comforting and, it's a better story for us that we can look back on in Scripture. If the stone hadn't itself been rolled away, even though it technically wasn't necessary, but it becomes very important in our assurance, in just the image that we're given when we read Scripture and we see that.
Yeah, I mean, it's evidentiary, right, in that sense. Mm-hmm. That you have the witnesses to the resurrection, not only seeing see, you have an empty tomb, which means it's the same body of Jesus that they see later, right? If mm-hmm. you didn't roll away that stone, and Jesus appeared to them, well, how do they know that there's not a body still in the tomb, right? Right. So there could still be all sorts, he was just an imposter. This is just someone else that looks a lot like him. You know, you can have all sorts of weird things happen.
Those rumors were already there.
Well, true. But these squelch. Anyway, those, yes. put them away more so in a way that is, you know, obviously in Matthew's gospel, we read about the Jews making up lies, paying off the soldiers. So what you have, though, is just a wonderful way of the disciples, like you said, it's an assuring thing for God's, Christ's disciples mm-hmm. to say or see the empty tomb and for that same image of an open and empty tomb to come down to us over the centuries that we can have visually in our mind's eye, so to speak. Just whatever we might think of when we see an empty tomb, right? He is out of there, right? A mm-hmm. carved open tomb that had never been used, you know, like, right, brand new tomb, and Jesus not there. Just an angel, right? Mm-hmm. Not just an angel. An angel with the linen clothing that Jesus was wrapped in. It is, as you said, visually assuringly spiritually stunning in the sense of what's the wow factor, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if you haven't read the story before, right? Now, we've read it multiple times, hundreds of times. We've heard it preached on multiple, if not hundreds of times throughout our lives. So it's the challenge for us is to remain in the wow factor. This is Jesus who said he would be crucified, suffer, die, and be raised up on the third day. And it happened, right? Mm-hmm. And the Pharisees and Sadducees, the council, they knew he had said this, which is why they set up guards, they asked Pilate for guards, and mm-hmm. why they were so concerned. And it went ahead and it happened. And then, you know, how do we know? They had to pay him off. You know, don't say anything about this. I mean, I mean, there is a hardness of heart. Being the guards, we saw it that it was happened. I mean, we didn't see the actual happening of it, but we see the evidence of it. But we'll take the money.
right. They get knocked unconscious by the awe of everything that's happening, and we'll just take the money. Like you said, the hardness of heart. It's incredible to think about. And that's that. I always think of when we're told, even if somebody were to be raised from the dead, you know, this is again back to the rich man and Lazarus. You know, even if somebody comes back from the dead, they won't believe. Which is significant. I think it's foreshadowing in the story to Christ. You know, even Christ himself coming back from the dead, that the depravity of our hearts without the work of the Holy Spirit will reject him.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, you know, he's risen from the dead. So, I mean, just let's get our bearings and what that means. This is a man who was dead, pierced side, wounds in his hands or wrists and feet, lacerations all over his back. A crown of thorns. So these large, thick, thorned bushes that would fashion into a crown, a headpiece that would be squished and crushed onto his head, piercing his face, his head. So great, great torment, mocked, spat upon, all sorts of humiliation. This man, this is dead. His heart stopped beating. Brain function was gone. His soul left his body. Yeah. Right? He's a human being who is God, but he has to have every aspect of a human being in order to be a human being. So he has a soul. His soul has left his body to be with the Father, right? Presumably. That's right. Because he says to the one of the men, right, on the cross, or next to him on the cross, "Today you'll be with me in paradise," one of the thieves, or the robbers.
Right.
So, and that man, his spirit returns, his soul returns, his heart starts pumping again, his brain starts working again,
right.
He is revived, his lungs start to breathe, his blood starts to pump, everything is rejuvenated, everything is brought back to life, everything is as it should be, and even better working, right? We assume it's the same body that he has in heaven now. I think there might be some debate about whether or not, like, does he still have his pierced hands in glory? Like, did they remain? If so, how is it a glorified body? Like, will we have our injuries, our markings? Right. So I think there's some discussion about whether or not he still has the wounds, right? He has them after his resurrection, but is there a transition in the body once he goes up into in the midst of the ascension? That's an in-house discussion that we don't need to get into right now, but he has the wounds still,
right?
So that people like Thomas can put his hands in and see later,
right?
As evidence that it's the same Jesus. So this is the wonder of a man becoming alive again, this God-man, and that we must have some sense of awe over, and not just on Easter Sunday, right? We you know, we preachers who are listening, we need to be preaching this resurrection regularly, right? We need to be preaching the wonder of being united to this resurrected man, God-man in heaven. I'm just trying to, he's resurrected.
Right.
And then he talks and walks around with people, right? The road to Emmaus, the 500 that Paul talks about, all sorts of different people he makes himself known to in his resurrected estate. And 50 days after Pentecost, or after Passover on Pentecost, he meets with his disciples again, right? Goes to Galilee, goes to Jerusalem, meets with them. Or no, not to Jerusalem. They 50 days later is when Pentecost comes.
Yeah, it's 40 days that
40 days later. Thank you.
40 days.
And then he ascends into heaven.
Right.
And they see him ascend on clouds. Mm-hmm. And the angel says, "Don't worry. He'll come back just like you see him now."
Yeah.
And I take that to with the biblical Old Testament biblical language of he's going to return on a cloud. But a cloud of war. And as riding on a chariot, meeting out his judgment and justice on the earth. Now that gets us ahead. That's a part of the exaltation, but that gets us ahead. But as the ascension, right? I mean, the ascension is pretty awesome.
And then
what happens after the ascension? Or I don't know, maybe I've been blabbing along here. Did you have anything to say about the ascension?
Well, we're going back to when he's actually resurrected. And you're not saying anything other than this, that the body that comes to life is a transformed body into a glorified body. And scripture does talk about, you know, a difference between the bodies of our earthly body that is perishable and our glorified bodies, which are imperishable and they're eternal. And so, it's the same. You know, it's still the same body, but it has been transformed into its glorification. And, you know, what you were saying, I know that you were saying that there is some, you know, was it the complete glorification at that time, or was that when he ends up in heaven? Where, like you're talking about the scars and that, you know, and I don't know. I think, does he still have the scars? I don't know. If I had to lean toward one way, I'd say yes, actually. But I'm fine for those who want to say, you know, no, that was just for that intermediate time, that those 40 days, so that he can show Thomas and the other disciples, so that he, because he hadn't been fully brought back to his glorification that he has right now in heaven. And so there is this transition period. And because I think people are really, like what you're saying, I think will be very new to a lot of people. The idea that that he wasn't fully glorified upon resurrection, that there might have been some sort of significant change to his body when he reaches heaven. I don't think most people would have ever heard that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the point there draw doubt into anyone. I'd say this is a body that was raised and made fit for heaven. But the question I have, because you use the language of scars, and I don't use
wounds. Hear, yeah, it might be better to say wounds
because you know he's like, Thomas, put your hand in here, right?
Yeah,
and it's kind of ooh, and touch it, you know. And so, and obviously he's not still bleeding. He's not suffering, right? These are not things that are harming him anymore, which is still also, well, what does that mean for this body? So the reason only reason I bring that up is because when we talk about our bodies, our resurrected bodies in glory, we talk about them in a perfected estate we don't usually think of them as having wounds or scars even.
Right.
So that's the only reason I bring it up, because Jesus still does, and he's still eating, right? He's eating fish right, with the disciples. Right.
And yeah, you assume he'd be drinking as well.
Yeah, yeah, eating whatever, and drinking, and
no matter
such.
What it is.
And you know, I mean, right. we were having family worship, and you know, it was mentioned. Well, when we eat in heaven, are we going to be eating meat? I mean, there's no death. So he's eating fish. His body was still able to eat fish, even and if it was his glorified body, is that still the same? I don't know, right? These are questions we don't have answers to. But things that pop into kids' heads and then parents' heads, and then we're like, oh goodness, I don't know how to answer that.
Yeah, it's perfectly fine to think about. I think that I guess my emphasis is there because we talk about how Christ and his resurrection is the first fruits.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Just as he has been raised, we will be raised. And so I want to make sure that we keep that continuity.
Yeah.
Not that you're not doing that, but.
No. And actually I wanted to come back to that because I think this is super significant, and I'm not sure. I hope we all think of it in these terms. But I love thinking about the resurrection, the way that Dr. Dick Gaffin taught it. And this has to do with the first fruits language. If you think of the events of the cross, of Christ, the Christ event, we might say, in his coming, in his first coming. So if you think of his first coming as one whole thing that happened, one whole event, one whole redemptive event, his incarnation, his suffering, his death, his resurrection, ascension, if that's just one thing that happened, and then you think of his return as another thing that happened or will happen. Okay, we tend to think of those as two very distinct things. And they are distinct things, historically speaking. Obviously, one hasn't happened, the other has. But when Christ refers to, or when it's referred to, his resurrection as the first fruits of the resurrection to come, that language has to do with one event, the first fruits of a harvest, not of harvests, right? One harvest.
Right.
And so I find this so wonderfully assuring, getting back to language of assurance here, because if Jesus was raised from the dead, as Paul teaches, of course, as we see in the Gospels, if Jesus is raised from the dead, as he was, and it is called the first fruits of the resurrection harvest, that means the harvesting has begun. And he's the first fruits. And it's an event that must happen. And so you can think of, or that not must happen, is happening. And you think of Jesus as the first fruits. That means that it's just the beginning of a harvest that has yet to be completed, which means that it's going to happen. Right? In the sense that there's no doubt. There's no doubt about it because it's already begun, and it began in Jesus. And our resurrection is a part of his. So ours has to happen as surely as his has happened. And I think Dick Gaffin talked about it in these terms. So if you think about the resurrection as a point in history, and you think about the future resurrection as a point in history, don't think about them as two points that have a circle around them. Right, as two distinct things, but make an ellipse around the two main points. That's what an ellipse is geometrically, right? It has two main points, not one. And so you think about the resurrection as an elliptical event, meaning that it has two centers, so to speak, Christ's and ours. And it's one event, one resurrection event. Ours is as sure to come as Christ's did come and did happen. So anyway, I might be the only one that gets so stinking excited about it, but I think that's really cool. And it kind of blew my mind away when I was first learning it. And obviously I don't know if anyone else can tell, but my excitement about it continues. Maybe it's just that I'm tired. But I find that very delightful. Then when you add the overlap of the ages, the Paul's eschatology on top of that, and you listen and talk about union with Christ and Union with the Resurrected Christ, which I haven't read it yet, right. But G.K. Beale has a whole book, a brand new book on that subject, Union with the Resurrected Christ. That means our union currently with the resurrected Christ in heaven now. And it's just, to me, it all comes together with just this wonderful beauty and assurance and spiritual satisfaction and spiritual vigor and power. That's all wrapped up in this, what we're, you know, we've been talking about in the exaltation, the estate of Christ's exaltation, because it brings in the next thing too. So we've talked about resurrection and we've talked about ascension a bit, but then it brings in Christ's session, which I'm not sure how much we really talk about that much these days. In Presbyterian circles, it's not like a part of our catechism right. or anything. It is in Reform circles, in the three forms of unity. In Presbyterian circles, the only time we hear about a session is in when a session meets.
Right.
So we move from the resurrection to the ascension, and then we get brought into this language of the session of Christ at God's right hand. And if that language is foreign to some of you, it's, I mean, in Presbyterian circles, we use that term, but we use it primarily with regard to the local church's board of elders, as some might call it, right? It's the governing body of a local church, the session. But in our brethren in the Reformed churches who use the three forms of unity, the language of session is found within their confessional documents. And all that means is it is when Christ is seated at the Father's right hand. That's what session means. And that's why a session of a local church in Presbyterianism is called a session, is because we are seated in making decisions and judgments. Now, that doesn't mean we actually can't stand up and walk around a room when we're doing this. That's not the point. Is the right. the language well, of what you're like? Oh goodness, Bob.
No. I think that's a great point. Actually, yeah. Actually, no. I think that's really important because there, you know, again, the people often will think of Christ literally sitting. That's how we should think of him. That he is. This isn't talking about. His posture. This is talking about where he. This is the ascension. That he is now reigning, as the God man, as the accomplished one. He has. It is finished. When he comes in his birth, the angels say he came to seek and to save that which was lost. You will call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Jesus himself says, I didn't come to do anything other than the Father had given me to do. And then at the cross, he says, it is finished. All that he came to do, it was finished on the earth in his humiliation. And now in his ascension, he is continuing the work of his kingdom. He is building his kingdom. He is destroying the kingdom of Satan. The gates of hell will not be able to withstand it. But he reigns with the Father as the victorious king.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's when it talks about he's seated in the heavenlies. He's seated at the right hand of the Father. It's not talking about his posture. It's talking about his role right now.
Yeah, and that's a role. This is actually not – it's mixed by way of his what I'm about to say. So we typically think of his role as a role of judgment. In a good sense, he's making judgment, you know, this is good, this is bad, right? His role is government, right? And a government shouldn't be upon his shoulders, right? He is king, and he is the only king of Christ's church, no popes, okay? No, he's the only priest of God's church, no popes. We only go to the one true mediator who is at God's right hand, and that is Jesus, who has his session. He is seated in decision-making process, in governing, let's just use that language, in governing the universe. But we see this every now and then. We see it when Jesus tends to Stephen. So in this sense, I don't mean to, like, I'm not trying to disagree with you or anything here, Rob, but I think that there is a posture element to this when when Jesus comes to Stephen, Jesus stands up. He's standing. To minister to him. And so it has come to us in this way that when Jesus is reigning, right, it's not like he's not reigning when he's serving, but when Jesus is in the posture of king and reigning, he is seated, right, as a king sits on his throne, right, and makes judgments and rules from his throne. Mm-hmm. But when he stands up to serve, that's like his role as the great deacon of the church. And he serves Stephen, and he goes to him in Stephen's time of need. And that's what Stephen sees. Stephen sees Jesus standing to tend to him. And I think that's just I think those are important images, not that you're throwing images of Jesus in your mind, but the image of the standing Jesus, the image of a seated Jesus. These are things that are meant, figuratively speaking, to give the different ongoing postures of Jesus in his ministry to the church now. He does serve the church through mercy. He does serve the church through his governing power, right? And it's explained and given us this imagery of seating and standing. And I think that's just a beautiful thing for us to have. And especially in Acts, when Stephen is stoned and he looks up and he sees his Savior there serving him, coming to tend to him and caring for him, providing for him in his need. And you can almost imagine the same posture of Jesus toward the martyrs of old, the saints of old who are persecuted to death. And he's there for them. And I don't know, maybe Jesus opens the eyes of saints as they're dying for martyrdom or other means, maybe not all, but for some, and reveals himself in this way, like he did to Stephen, to comfort in the midst of their trial and of their suffering at that time. I don't know if that's the case. I don't have any reports or anything like that. But, you know, we have this one revelation of the first martyr, this happening to him, and it's just... You see the tender mercy of our Savior Jesus, that it's the same Jesus who is tender and merciful, right? I am gentle and lowly, as, you know, the new book has really tried to emphasize by Dane Ortlund. But that's how Jesus describes himself. You have the same Jesus of who he was on earth and his kindness, his compassion, his care. Now he's in heaven. Mm-hmm. He has that same kindness. He has that same compassion. It doesn't go away. He's the same person, the God-man. And it's just beautiful to see. And I'm, again, probably blabbing on, but that's the session. He's in his current reign at the Father's right hand. That's the session of Christ. Once again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. You can find us, of course, at reformedforum.org, and you can find out all about all the wonderful resources there as well. And check out the events page so that you can take a look at the upcoming conference that will be it's a few months off now, of course, but in October. And this being the 100th year anniversary of Christianity and Liberalism, the conference will be on that book by J. Gresham Machen. So take a look at that. See if there's some speakers there that you might want to travel to see and hear and discuss this important book of the early 20th century and see how it's still relevant today. You can also, you know, go on to reformforum.org. You can find an audiobook version of that read by me. Little self-promo there, but also really great discussions by Camden with special guests on each chapter of that book that have been being rolled out over the past several months. And also, if you want to check out the congregation that Rob and I serve, you can go to westminsteropc.org and chicagoreformed.org to find out about all the other OPC congregations within the Chicagoland area. Rob, what are we doing next time?
Next time we'll talk about Christ as prophet, priest, and king.
Oh, excellent. Well, again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.